right here, I've just started a map. They've been camping at Gilgal. They have destroyed Jericho. They had had trouble with Ai because at Jericho, a place that was supposed to be harem, a total dedication, nothing was to be taken. The Babylonian garment and the some gold wedges had been taken, and that was discovered in Achan's tent. It was brought out with using the Urim and the Thummim and some divine intervention. And we ended up last week in chapter 7. In chapter 7, verse 24, then Joshua, together with all the Israel, took Achan, the son of Zerah, the silver and the robe and the gold wedges, his sons and daughters and everything, and took him to the valley of Achor. Joshua says, why have you brought this trouble on us? The Lord will bring trouble on you today. And they stoned him and buried him there in the valley of Achor. And now tonight they're going to get ready to go back to Ai. Remember, they'd attacked Ai with just a few men and had been driven back. Had great success at Jericho. And now they're going to begin now, or continue with this central or the entrance campaign. It's going to turn into a central campaign here this evening as Joshua continues to march across. We're right around biblical history. We're right around 1400 BC. So sometime between 1400 BC, 1300 BC is where these things take place. The way I would date them, some people like to push them a little bit. All kinds of different ways of trying to explain these stories. Some push them at a much later date, say, 1200, not much later, but again, a later Exodus. Some make this as just legend and folklore that the Israelites have recorded for, a glorification of their own country, that all these places, they just kind of migrated in, a few people here, kind of just come across the border and setting up and getting jobs and working and just kind of took over the land that way. That's why some people think, the minimalists like to teach it that way. I like to look at it, and I'm not alone. This is the date that about the time that they were taking the land. This is the days of Joshua, and that these were actual wars or battles that they fought. Amarna letters. That's a place in Egypt, because Egypt was, of course, important at this time. These Canaanites, and this is now historical documents, that we have the clay tablets that had been sent from these kings from these different cities down to their leaders down in Egypt, and just corresponding back and forth. One of the major cities was Jerusalem, and other places that were corresponding. Names of their kings are listed. And during this time, in these Amarna letters, Jerusalem is mentioned, but also mentions of invasions, of kings getting overrun, and then forming coalitions to come against the invaders, asking Egypt for help. If you don't come help us, there won't be anything left. Reports of city after city falling. All during this time period, some people think it is a record of the Canaanite kings asking Egypt for help with Joshua's invasion. Now, again, Joshua's name is not mentioned, but it does sound very similar, and it doesn't give us a necessarily direct connection, but something was going on in the land at this time, according to these letters. But anyway, we are in chapter 8, verse 1. After they'd killed Achan in the valley of Achor, then the Lord said to Joshua, do not be afraid, do not be discouraged. Take the whole army with you and go up and attack Ai, for I have delivered into your hands the king of Ai, his people, his city, and his land. Now, that's Ai right here. Just north of Ai is going to be a city called Bethel. And again, we're familiar with that. There we just read about the king of Ai. So it's kind of wondering, we still kind of wonder how this whole thing was set up, how the land of Canaan was set up at this time. Were they all individuals? Like, there's going to be Adonai Zedek is going to be the king of Jerusalem. We've mentioned the king of Ai, the king of Bethel. Joshua's going to be defeating kings. So it appears that each city was like a city-state in itself with its own king. Some people have considered possibly Bethel had some forts around, that Ai was a very small city, and it was just a fortress or one of the forts protecting a larger city of Bethel. But because it says the king of Ai, it gives the impression, again, of a city-state. As far as reading this, it says the Lord just says, do not be afraid, do not be discouraged. That's encouraging news, but you have to go back and read the chapter before, where maybe you should be afraid and maybe you should be discouraged when if you have sinned. You see, the ideal is that they've now walked away from sin. They're walking in God's will. He says, do not be afraid, do not be discouraged. But that really didn't work real well for Achan. Achan should be afraid. Achan should be discouraged. But how come? Because God was no longer with him because he had sinned. So just kind of, I like to keep that in mind. In fact, I got it in a little note right here in my Bible. I wrote, but obviously, if you have sin, you should be afraid and discouraged. In other words, it's just not this blanket saying, be of good cheer, everything's going to be fine. Wait a minute, do you see that pile of stones with Achan buried underneath? It didn't end well for him. So if you do have sin, or if you're hiding sin, this is not just a blanket statement, everything's going to be fine, be of good cheer. This is talking to Joshua because he's dealt with the sin. They're going back into God's plan. So again, they're back. He says, I've delivered the land, or the Ai and its king, into your hand. Verse 2, you shall do to Ai and its king as you did to Jericho and its king, except that you may carry off their plunder and livestock up for yourselves, set an ambush behind the city. So this is different. Again, they're going to destroy it, but you can plunder it. We saw in archaeological remains and God's command, Jericho was not to be plundered. Jericho was to be destroyed. The whole thing offered up. But now, throughout the rest of the invasions, these cities can be plundered. It's for their taking. It's part of conquering the land. They're going to go ahead, and he's going to set an ambush. On the west side of Ai, he's going to end up putting, he's going to send 25,000 men over onto this side, and part of them are going to stay back, and part of them are going to come into the city, and Josh is going to keep 5,000 men with himself. So we're going to read right here, at night he's going to send some men over on the west side, over between Ai and Bethel. Part of that contingent is going to be the ambush that takes Ai. Part of them is probably going to end up being like a barrier between Bethel and Ai in case Bethel comes out to help. And then Joshua is going to lead an attack with 5,000 men up against Ai to reenact the situation. And as soon as the king gets up from Ai to attack him back, Joshua is going to lead his men in a retreat. And they're going to think, aha, we got everybody running. They're going to empty the city out. Well, let's just read it right here and read the account. So Joshua, verse 3, so Joshua and the whole army moved out to attack Ai. He chose 30,000 of his best fighting men and sent them out at night with these orders. Listen carefully. You are to set an ambush behind the city. Don't go very far from it. All of you will be on alert. I and all those with me will advance on the city, and then the men come out against us as they did before. We will flee from them. They will pursue us until we have lured them away from the city, for they will say they are running away as they did before. Now just notice, God is using their previous mistake. Their sin or their mistake or their disaster, Israel's, is now going to be used to their advantage. You will rise up from the ambush and take the city. The Lord your God will give it into your hands. When you have taken the city, set it on fire. Do what the Lord has commanded. See to it. You have my orders. Then Joshua sent them off, and they went up to the place of ambush and lay in wait between Bethel and Ai to the west of Ai. But Joshua spent that night with the people. Early the next morning, Joshua mustered his men, and he and his leaders, now remember, they've got 30,000 men back on this side. There's going to have 5,000 going to come in and attack, 25,000 going to stay back. Early the next morning, Joshua mustered his men, and he and the leaders of Israel marched before them to Ai. The entire force that was with him marched up and approached the city and arrived in front of it. They set up camp north of Ai with the valley between them and the city. Joshua had taken about 5,000 men and set them in ambush between Bethel and Ai to the west of the city. They had the soldiers take up their positions, all those encamped to the north, now it's got 30,000, of that city in ambush to the west, 5,000. That night, Joshua went into the valley. So now he's sitting there waiting for it. Then the king of Ai saw this, that Joshua was getting ready for the attack in the morning. He and all the men of the city hurried out early in the morning to meet Israel in battle at the certain place overlooking the Arabah. Or again, let's get a little bit of topography here. This is going to be the coastal plain right here. Coastal plain over on this side. So this is very flat. This is again where one of the major highways was as far as traveling. The armies would always travel back and forth up and down the coast. We get into some foothills. Get some foothills happening here, rising to the peak, kind of like a ridge running right down the middle of the land of Israel. Jerusalem being on that peak, very rugged. To ride up into this land, from this point, you'd be going uphill all the way, very steep climb into this part of the city, up part of the country, until you got about to this ridge right here. At this point right here, even in Jerusalem, you'd start going down towards the Araba, right here. That's the Jordan Valley. So this is low. This is a valley. And this part right here is the desert. So Joshua's running or fleeing back towards the Araba. And realize there's a ridge right here. As you go up and over, you're going to come down to the coastal plain. And all this is going to play into our picture tonight. It's coastal plain, foothills, rolling up into some mountainous territory, including Jerusalem, and then dropping down into the Araba Valley. Now, somewhere in one of my books, and you can see it different places, there's a topography, a picture of the topography, and you just see how steep this goes up. And that's going to be important because Joshua's fleeing down into that Araba. I lost my place, Joshua 15. Verse 16, all the men of Ai were called to pursue them, and they pursued Joshua and were lured away from the city. Not a man remained in Ai, not a good idea, or Bethel, who did not go after Israel. So Bethel does come out into the attack. They left the city open and went in pursuit of Israel. Then the Lord said to Joshua, hold out towards Ai the javelin that is in your hand. Now, the word javelin is K-I-D-O-N, just so you know, K-I-D-O-N. It is a word that refers to a curved sword. Sometimes it would be referred to as a sickle sword. You can see these on Egyptian monuments from this time. It's got a handle with like a hooked blade on it, almost like it's a sickle sword or a curved sword. It's translated javelin here. That's fine. But the word is K-I-D-O-N. It means a sickle sword or a curved sword. So Joshua, it's interesting that he's fighting with something that could be very, very familiar in Egypt. So he's going to hold, when he gets so far away, he's going to turn and hold that sickle sword or the javelin here. For in your hand I'll deliver the city. So Joshua held out his javelin towards Ai. As soon as he did this, the men in the ambush rose quickly, so they were in position to see him retreat, but also see him turn and hold the sickle sword up or hold the javelin up. They entered the city and captured it and quickly set it on fire. Now they're not just burning it, they're also plundering it. The men that they came from this west side in, Joshua's headed down to the Araba. Now he's going to turn back on his pursuers, which includes the military of Bethel and Ai, including their kings. They're being Ai is being overrun from the west side now by the ambush. The men of Ai looked back and saw the smoke of the city rising against the sky. And of course, that's got to be a very defeated feeling. But they had no chance to escape in any direction for Israel, for the Israelites who had been fleeing towards the desert had turned back against their pursuers. For when Joshua and all Israel saw that the ambush had taken the city and that smoke was going up from the city, they turned around and attacked the men of Ai. The men of the ambush also came out of the city against them. So once they got the city smoked and they had it plundered, they came out and they again sandwiched the original pursuers between Joshua's return and themselves. The men of the ambush also came out of the city so that they were caught in the middle with Israel on both sides. Israel cut them down, leaving them neither survivors nor fugitives, but they took the king of Ai alive and brought him to Joshua. So there's their king. When Israel had finished killing all the men of Ai in the fields and in the desert where they had chased them, that'd be down toward into the Araba, towards the Jordan, towards the Dead Sea. When they had finished killing them, all the men of Ai in the fields in the desert where they had chased them, and when every one of them had been put to the sword, all the Israelites returned to Ai and killed those who were in it. 12,000 men and women fell that day, and all the people of Ai. For Joshua did not draw back the hand that held out his javelin until he had destroyed all who lived in Ai. But Israel did carry off for themselves the livestock, the plunder of the city, as the Lord had instructed Joshua. So they did get to take all the plunder and livestock. So Joshua burned Ai and made it a permanent heap of ruins. It has really not been identified today. There's a couple locations that they can say this could be the city, but again, it seems to be a smaller city. Even the men said it was a smaller city, and it was totally destroyed, and there's some spots identified, but nothing for sure. At sunset, Joshua ordered them to take, verse 29, he hung the king of Ai on a tree and left him there until evening. At sunset, Joshua ordered them to take his body from the tree and throw it down at the entrance of the city gate, and they raised a pile of rocks over it, which remains to this day. So again, the king would be buried at his city gate with a bunch of rocks and the walls and everything been burnt, him buried there. When it says he was hanged, that can be probably an impaling where they take the dead body and put it up into a tree, like hang it, you know, in a tree somehow. Not necessarily by a rope by the neck. You know, that's another what we you know, the Wild West of hanging like that. But this would be more like impaled. This would be similar to what the Assyrians maybe do, was expose the body to demonstrate victory. We have impaled the king. He is dead. Another way that could be interpreted would be that they could stretch him out and have him stretched between branches or something, another way that it would be done. But again, when it says hung from a tree, that is what no body is to be reigned. Hung from a tree, as we've seen the law that Moses wrote, overnight. So when as the sun starts setting, those bodies need to be taken down and put into a tomb. It was something that the Lord forbid. If it had to do with culture, if it had to do with God's law, whatever, there's different ways of looking at why it was like this. But God did not want a dead body, like an enemy's body, exposed overnight. If you could hang someone and defeat a city and hang the king, but that you can't, you know, in a sense, exploit their defeat. You can't get into the necromancy and all the spirits of the evening and different things. There'd be a lot of different strange things that could be taking place there, especially in a culture that's overrun with witchcraft and what the Canaanites have. So you could expose the king to show that you defeat or that you've defeated him, but you could not exploit the body and you could not get into the demonic activities and things that could go around with a dead body. So now, what has taken place, we've now defeated Bethel, Ai, Jericho, have been defeated on this entrance campaign. We're going to get some concern now from Jerusalem. Now, right over here, let's get some other cities on here. If we come over here from Ai, let's go ahead and clean this map up just a little bit. And you may want to refer to a good map, like in your Bibles, as you kind of see these places. But here's Gilgal, here's Jericho, here's Jerusalem. Coming out of Jericho, here's going to be Ai, and Bethel is up here. Oh, excuse me. I'm going to move the cities around, move my dot. There's Bethel. Up above Bethel, you're going to have the cities of Shechem, which is where we're heading. Right up in here is going to be Shechem. And north of that is, I'm going to write an E for Mount Ebal, a G for Mount Gerizim. Between Bethel and Shechem, right in here, again, this is very sloppy, is the city of Shiloh. And that's where the Ark of the Covenant is going to be set up, or the tabernacle. We're heading next, right up to this area here, up to Shechem, for the Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim, the reconfirming of the covenant. But what we've lost, what they've lost so far, they've lost this territory right here. Meanwhile, the king of Jerusalem is going to start getting some of his friends together, his other kings, realizing we've got to put a stop to this. Right north of Jerusalem, like 7 miles north of Jerusalem, there's the high place of Geba. We've talked about it. That's where Samuel anointed Saul. That's the high place of Geba right here. Right at the base of that is the city city of the Gibeonites. So you've got the Gibeonites in the city of Gibeon at the base of a large place, a very high place called Geba. And this is right on a ridge that is like a high ridge of mountains. Again, like I said, this rises up. And as this will then, you follow this ridge, there's a city called Beth Horon. And that's an important city in a variety of, not necessarily today it's going to be important, but when we get into biblical history, as far as events that take place, even in the Maccabees, this rise coming out of the coastal plain, hitting the foothills, going through the Aijalon. There's an Aijalon Valley here, next to a city called Aijalon. But you rise up the Beth Horon Ridge that kind of goes up this way in through Geba and past the Gibeonites. It's a very important road right here. Anyway, this land has been defeated. Joshua's heading up here to Shechem to renew the covenant with the people and the Lord. The king of Jerusalem, Adonai Zedek, is going to start getting people together, and the Gibeonites are going to say, we've got our own plan. And they're going to go up and make a treaty. The news of this defeat is going to spread all the way to the western coast over here, and these cities are going to start saying, what are we going to do about this? Because they've just been overrun. And from Jericho, Ai, Bethel, all these things. Okay, we're in chapter 8, verse 30. Then Joshua built on Mount Ebal an altar. Now, if you go up on Mount Ebal and look, and that Mount Ebal is just to the... And I gave you a picture of this a few weeks ago of Shechem and kind of an altar there in between Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal, altar, a holy place that may have been there since the days of Abraham, been used in the days of the judges, and it's clearly still has some remains of the wall of the ancient city of Shechem that you can still see very clearly. And you can see on the hill rising here on Ebal to the north. On the third highest peak of this mound right here. Now, when we say mountain, we're not talking snow-capped mountains, okay? We're talking, I mean, there's houses on the side. It's like a large hill coming down into a valley with another large hill on this side. And again, like I said, I've gave you a picture of that earlier. On the third highest peak there is a plain or an area large enough for a group of people that's going to meet here. And they have uncovered an altar made out of field stones that matches this from this time period. And it looks like it matches. They've got the date set. The archaeologists dated it between 1250 and 1300 B.C. of when this altar that has been uncovered on Mount Ebal. So it's right in the ballpark there. It's as far as the date, the stones, the location, the pottery that's been found around it, it matches. So it appears they've located where this altar is. Here we go. Then Joshua built on Mount Ebal an altar to the Lord, the God of Israel, as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded the Israelites. In Deuteronomy 11, 26, and in Deuteronomy 27, verses 1 through 8, Moses told them, do this. When you get across, remember Moses over here on the other side before he died, he gave them direction. When you get across here, go to Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim and do this. And one of the things he's going to tell them to do, we're going to read about it right here, because it's going to say in verse 32, there in the presence of the Israelites, Joshua copied on stone the law of Moses, which he had written. And so Joshua is going to write on some stone there. Now, what Moses says, go back to chapter 27 of Deuteronomy, and you can see what they did. I may have mentioned a few weeks ago about the Balaam inscription. Did we ever talk about the Balaam inscription that was found over in the land of Moab from right around the time, you know, within a few centuries after the time of Balaam, but refers to Balaam? It was another prophecy of his outside of Scripture, and nothing that refers to Scripture except his name and his father's name and some of the prophecies that he'd given. But what they would do, they would take a stone, and this would explain some of the stones that we ever see standing up. You see the monumental stones just stood up, and it's like they just stood up a stone. Sometimes they just stood up a stone. But a lot of times they would stand up the stone, and then they would cover it with plaster. And so they'd plaster it or whitewash the stone. And then in the plaster, in the soft plaster, that's when they would do exactly what Joshua does, write in the stone. You understand what I'm saying? Not so much that, you know, Joshua's going to sit down and he's going to take the book of Deuteronomy or the book of, you know, Exodus or something and take it and say, it'll just take me a minute here and start chiseling out the book of Exodus or the book of Deuteronomy. You know, maybe so. But Moses says, write in plaster. Here they're going to write in stone. That what they would do, even the plaster inscription of, for example, that Balaam had that was written, was a part of the wall that was plastered, and then his prophecy was written in the plaster, and then it hardens like stone. So I'm going to tell you what I think. They're on Mount Ebal. They build themselves an altar. They stand up some stones, kind of like what we saw at right over here. We were right here, some of us were over here, Gezer, and we saw those stones standing up at Gezer with that stone box. We're in the middle of somebody's field at Gezer. I mean, it's not like, oh, we're in somebody's field, and there's a stone box, I don't know, like something like this big. It appears to have had a cover on it. Imagine the mercy seat, you know, some kind of a cover. It wasn't the Ark of the Covenant, but I mean, imagine the Ark of the Covenant was a box with the mercy seat that sat on it with the cherubim. Here in this field, or the excavation of the city of ancient Gezer, there was a box, a stone box that we could still see, but there's no cover on it. Obviously, it's been plundered and taken away some other time. But standing in back behind it was some large, I mean, as tall as the ceiling, stones, you know, some here and some over here, you know, like three or four, I can't remember the numbers. But they're just stones. And clearly, I mean, I'll say clearly, to me, I think it's clear, this was a site of a ceremony, some kind of a ceremony at Gezer. Now, I don't know if it was the tribes of Israel getting together, if it was something left over from the days of the Canaanites. There's probably several options that was taking place. But what we saw there at Gezer is what they're doing here at Ebal. They put together an altar. They stood up a stone or some stones. They covered them in plaster so they're nice. They look good. And while it's soft, they're writing their covenant in the stone. And in Gezer's case, there would have had maybe a copy of the covenant placed in that box, covered it up, and this was the sign of the ceremony, the sign of the covenant cutting. That's what's taking place here at Ebal. And they've already done this at Mount Sinai, but they're doing it now in the land, a renewal of the covenant with another generation in the actual land. And here it goes. Chapter 8, verse 30. Then Joshua built on Mount Ebal an altar to the Lord, the God of Israel, as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded the Israelites. He built it according to what was written in the book of the law of Moses, an altar of uncut stones on which no iron tool had been used. On it they offered to the Lord burnt offerings and sacrificed fellowship offerings. Again, there's bones of on this altar, the remains that they found cattle, sheep, and some local deer that had been offered on this altar at Ebal. No pigs. On it they offered the Lord the offerings. Verse 32, there in the presence of the Israelites, Joshua copied on stone the law of Moses, which he had written. All Israel, aliens and citizens alike. Interesting, those that had come along and joined them. With their elders, officials, and judges were standing on both sides of the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, facing those who carried it, the priests who were Levites. Half the people stood on Mount Gerizim to the south, and half of them stood on Mount Ebal, which is to the north, as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had formerly commanded them when he gave instructions to bless the people of Israel. That would be in Deuteronomy 11 and 27, particularly 27. Afterward, Joshua read all the words of the law, the blessings and the curses, just as it is written in the book of the law. There was not a word of all that Moses had commanded that Joshua did not read to the whole assembly of Israel, including the women and the children and the aliens and all who lived there. So there you have the ceremony of the covenant. Again, they have the Ark of the Covenant. The priests are there. The Ark of the Covenant is going to end up here at Shiloh. This is where the tabernacle is going to end up being set until the Philistines overrun it in the book of 1 Samuel. But that is Mount Ebal, Mount Gerizim. That's what's taking place. Now, meanwhile, this entrance campaign has been successful. While they're swearing or renewing the covenant, the Gibeonites are making some kind of a plan. The king Adonizedek of Jerusalem is organizing a coalition to fight. The western hill countries over here are afraid. They're trying to figure out what they're going to do. The Gibeonites say, we know, we're going to go deceive them. So here we go. Chapter 9. Now when all the kings west of the Jordan, so Jordan River, west of the Jordan, those in the hill country in the western foothill, so the hill country, that would be like where we're at right here, the hill country, like this is going to be the tribe of Benjamin, the hill country of Benjamin. The western foothills, that's what I was talking about. When you come off this coastal plain, you start getting rolling hills. Those are the western foothills over in this area, the Gezer, Ajalon. By the time you get to Beth Horon, you're into the actual, the rugged passes there. Let me read this again. In the western foothills and along the entire coast of the Great Sea, that's the coastal plain along the Mediterranean Sea, and then he gives you a list, as far as Lebanon. Now, you know where Lebanon's at. Lebanon is up here. That's north of Mount Carmel. That's up here along the coast north of Israel. And it gives you a list of the kings of the Hittites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites. They came together to make war against Joshua and Israel. So they're starting to form coalitions. We've got to stop these people. In other words, what they probably did, they probably stopped fighting each other long enough. We've got to unite and fight Joshua. However, when the people of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and Ai, they resorted to a ruse. They went as a delegation whose donkeys were loaded with worn-out sacks and old wineskins, cracked and mended. The men put worn and patched sandals on their feet and wore old clothes. They went down to the Salvation Army and started buying some old raggedy stuff that they could find. Not that all the stuff the Salvation Army is raggedy. They just didn't go down to the Gap or out at the mall to get their stuff. They put on worn patched clothes, and all the bread of their food supply was dry and moldy. Now, where'd they find that? I'm not sure. Maybe they laid it out for a few days. Then they sent to Joshua in the camp at Gilgal and said to him and the men of Israel, "We have come from a distant country. Make a treaty with us." The men of Israel said to the Hivites, now these are the Gibeonites, but the Gibeonites would be Hivites. But perhaps you live near us. How then can we make a treaty with you? We're under command to destroy you. We are your servants, they said to Joshua. But Joshua asked, who are you and where do you come from? They answered, your servants have come from a very distant country because of the fame of the Lord your God. Interesting. Now that's something they're going to want to believe. I mean, they've done a very good job of organizing their speech. They did some prep work before. They're going to flatter Joshua. They're going to flatter their God. You know, they're coming from a long way. We just came to honor your God. For we have heard reports of him, all that he did in Egypt and all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites east of the Jordan. Remember over here with Moses, with Sihon, king of the Heshbon, and Og, king of Bashan, who reigned in Ashtaroth. And our elders and those living in our country said to us, take provisions for your journey. Go and meet them and say to them, we are your servants. Make a treaty with us. This bread of ours, for example, was warm when we packed it at home on the day we left to come to you. But now see how dry and moldy it is. And these wineskins that were filled were new, but see how cracked they are. And our clothes and sandals are worn out by the long, very long journey. Now, verse 14, here's the problem. The men of Israel sampled their provisions. They checked physically what they thought they should look at, but they did not do any kind of a spiritual test. They did not hear, inquire of the Lord. Then Joshua made a treaty of peace with them to let them live, and the leaders of the assembly ratified it by an oath. Now, you know, I've always wondered about this, and there's something to be said about a treaty. There's something to be said. I mean, again, if we put it in this perspective, if for some reason you didn't read the fine print of a contract, or if you bought something online with your credit card, you know, and you gave them your numbers and everything, you made the purchase. Yes, but I thought it was a bigger item. I thought it was this or whatever. And there's some kind of deception involved. And again, there's a lot of deception involved in a lot of contracts. I mean, ever bought like, I remember one time we bought, when we used to buy cassette tapes, you know, you get, you know, for a penny, you get 10 cassette. What did you call that? It's always in the Des Moines or the Sunday paper. In the cartoon section. You even talk about, they used to be records, you know, you could buy all these records. Are you with me? Are you still with, what did we used to call that? Columbia, yeah, it used to be like a record club, or, yeah. Yeah. Larry, he came with the MP3s, yeah. No, it was our time, Larry. Yeah, no, And you'd send off a dollar, you'd send off a penny, and they'd send you 10 records or 10 cassette tapes. Oh, and I did that once, and I got my 10 cassette tapes, the ones I wanted. But then, and they were free, but shipping was $25. It's like, oh, and they're going to send you something every month or every week or something, and it's like, and I got to stop this. Well, I got another one. Well, the next one cost me $9 or something, or $4, plus shipping, which was another $20. It's like, oh, no. And I'm like $100 in debt. And it says, I can't stop this thing. And they don't answer their phone. It's like, you signed up now. Was there deception involved in that? Well, yeah, or just ignorance on my part. I just wanted it. I wanted it to be true. You know what I'm saying? I wanted to get these. And so I was willing to believe it. I agreed to it. And I couldn't call them and tell them, oh, I just made a mistake. It's like, yeah, we designed it for you to make a mistake. Send us the money. And the same thing here. The Gibeonites, Joshua, you know, when I read this at first, it's like, I remember reading this many years ago. Even now I read, I think, when Joshua finds out they lied to him, why don't you just kill them all? It's like, we made a covenant. Yeah, but you were deceived. But that's part of covenants. You understand what I'm saying? I don't want to say it's part of deceiving. But it's a deal. You're working the deal. You're brokering a deal for both parties. And they came in and they brokered a deal. We are going to be your servants and you're going to let us live. And Joshua, and they ratified it. Joshua agreed. They ratified it. It is an official document. So when they find out about it, they just can't kill them. They've got to do... Just like if you signed a contract. It's like, yeah, but I didn't know the fine print. Yeah, but you signed it. Is this your name? Well, yeah, but you signed it. And Joshua here signed a bad contract. He agreed to a bad covenant. or a covenant that he wasn't supposed to. So let's read this again here, pick this up. Thank you. All right, we'll go to verse 14. The men of Israel sampled their provisions, but did not inquire of the Lord. Then Joshua made a treaty of peace. And there it is. He signed the contract. He bought the record deal with them and to let them live. And the leaders of the assembly ratified it by an oath. They approved it. 3 days after they had made the treaty with the Gibeonites, the Israelites heard that they were neighbors living near them. Now, how they found out about this, we're not sure. So the Israelites set out. On the third day, they came to their cities. Gibeon, right here. Gibeonites are right here, just north of Geba. Geba is about 7 miles north of Jerusalem. I mean, you can stand on Geba, the high place of Geba right here. You can stand there and you can see Jerusalem. I mean, it's not like long ways away. You can stand there and look. It doesn't look like 7 miles. You can stand on the Mount of Olives and look and see the high place of Geba right here. You can stand on the Mount of Olives. You can see the Temple Mount. Then you look up here over the north of Jerusalem and you can see this. So you can look at these two places here. So the Israelites set out. They got their cities, Gibeon, Kerith, Beeroth, Kiroth, Jearim, and those are all going to pop up other places in the Bible. But the Israelites did not attack them because, it says, the leaders of the assembly had sworn an oath to them by the Lord, the God of Israel. They bring them, the Gibeonites are now brought into the covenant with Israel through this treaty, this contract. Now, how serious is this? You're going to run into this in the days of Saul. And we don't know much about this, and this is one of those bizarre stories. You're gonna run into it. It's like, are you serious? During Saul's reign, he apparently, I'm off subject now, but Saul apparently went through a phase of great patriotism or something where he was going to purify Israel. And it doesn't give us the story, it doesn't tell us what he did, but it appears that Saul killed a bunch of Gibeonites, just slaughtered them, just going to purge the land of these foreigners in Saul's, whenever Saul has a great idea, it's not necessarily a great idea, but in his false zeal. Because later on, now this should sober us up sometimes. Later on, after Saul was already dead, David was ruling, a famine came on the land. And it's like, what's going on? And they asked, you can read about it. They asked, what is this for? And it ended up being a famine in punishment of the land of Israel for Saul's sin. Now it's like, how fair is this? Saul mistreats the Gibeonites, who in the first place lied to Joshua, but they're in the covenant. Saul doesn't honor the covenant. He begins to slaughter the Gibeonites, and now the land is suffering, and they got asked, what do we do? And it's bizarre. You need to go back and read it yourself. I don't even like to tell you the story. They found out what they had to do, and this ties into Melchizedek, Mephibosheth. Remember when David's men came up to Mephibosheth and found where he was living, and he was afraid? That was because during this time, right before this time, remember why David went to look for Mephibosheth? Because is there anybody left of the household of Saul? Well, what happened to everybody between the death of Saul and Jonathan and David going looking for Mephibosheth? They needed to pay vengeance for what Saul had done. And the thing that was required was that the bodies of some of the sons of Saul they must be killed and exposed on the side of on the side of a hill somewhere, and then the famine would end. In fact, when they had those bodies laid out, and one of the mothers or Saul's wives was there keeping the vultures away from the bodies of her sons who were exposed, it started to rain. And then David, the next chapter, David says, I think it's the next chapter, says, is there anyone from the household of Saul left? They said, well, Mephibosheth lives up over on the other side over here. He said, well, go get him. Then all of a sudden, royal horses pull in to get Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth, no, they're coming to get me too. And David brings him back and puts him at his table. I mean, it's like, do you understand how Saul ends up killing the Gibeonites, and in David's reign, a plague or a famine comes on the land, and to solve the famine, they have to kill Saul's sons and put them on the side of a hill for the Gibeonites, and the Gibeonites give them forgiveness. They forgive the Israelites for what they did. It's like bizarre. It's like, that's not New Testament stuff. But anyway, here's the Gibeonites. Okay, so in other words, what it says right here, in the middle of verse 18, because the leaders of the assembly had sworn an oath to them by the Lord, the God of Israel. God's name gets drug into this. How serious was it? Well, we go to that what I was just saying about Saul. A famine was on the land, and God wasn't going to allow the famine to be broken until the Gibeonites were satisfied with some kind of punishment for Saul's sin against killing them during his patriotic vengeance there. And so God is going to be in on this. It's kind of hard to understand. Okay, the whole assembly grumbled against the leaders, of course. Now the political fallout takes place. Like, what did you do? But all the leaders answered, "We have given them our oath by the Lord, the God of Israel, and we cannot touch them now. We can't break our oath." And Saul's going to try. "This is what we will do to them. We will let them live." In other words, they manipulated the treaty. We'll manipulate the treaty. If you remember, they kept saying what? "We are your servants. We are your servants. We are your servants." They says, "Okay, we're going to go read the fine print. You said you are our servants, so you will be ours. We won't kill you, but you'll be our servants. We have given them the oath by the Lord, the God of Israel, and we cannot touch them now. This is what we will do to them. We will let them live so that the wrath will not fall on us for breaking the oath we swore to them." And Saul will break that oath, and wrath will fall. They continued, "Let them live, but let them be woodcutters and water carriers for the entire community." So the leaders' promise to them was kept. In other words, they kept their promise, but we're going to hold them to the contract. We need some more wood over here, and this family needs water, and they're having a little water problem down there. They became plumbers and furnace men. And they took care of the furnaces and took care of the plumbing. They carried water and carried the wood. That's what the giving, that's what they did. That was their careers. Nothing wrong with being a plumber or a furnace, air heating and air conditioning. I didn't mean that by any means. Or a shop teacher. So that's what they're going to do. Verse 22. Then Joshua summoned the Gibeonites and says, "Why did you deceive us by saying, 'We live a long ways away from you,' while actually you live near us? You are now under a curse. You will never cease to serve as woodcutters and water carriers for the house of my God." So you see right there, they were deceptive, and they didn't just skate off free. Their contract covenant that they deceived became a curse for them. And he says, "For the house of my God." In other words, they're going to work around the tabernacle also. They answered Joshua, "Your servants were clearly told how the Lord your God had commanded his servant Moses to give you the whole land and to wipe out all its inhabitants from before you. So we feared for our lives because of you." Again, that's a sign of faith. They believed the Lord was serious, and they're on the receiving end of his judgment. So it's like, what do you expect us to do? We believe in your Lord. We believe he's going to do what he says. So we were terrified. "We are now in your hands. Do to us whatever seems good and right to you." So Joshua saved them from the Israelites, because the Israelites wanted to kill him that day, which would have been a bad deal. And they did not kill them. That day he made the Gibeonites woodcutters and water carriers for the community and for the altar of the Lord at the place of the Lord would choose. Notice right there. For the community, they're going to be the furnace and the furnace people and the plumbers. But for the tabernacle or the temple, notice he doesn't say where it is. For the altar of the Lord at the place the Lord would choose. They do not know where that is yet. Where is it going to be? It's going to be Jerusalem. They don't know where that place is, but he says when we get that place located, it will be at Shiloh. Then it's going to be over at the high place of Geba. And then eventually it's going to go to Jerusalem. As it'll be tabernacle, remains of a tabernacle, and then the temple of Solomon. And that is what they are to this day. You can read more about it later. Okay, chapter 10. Now, Adonai Zedek. Again, I want to point out, we know who Melchizedek is. He's with Abraham's day, Melchizedek. And this name right here is Adonai Zedek. Just notice, Melchizedek was the king and priest in Jerusalem. And now we're 600 years later, Adonai Zedek, same Z-E-D-E-K, is now the king in Jerusalem. And when we talk about David's palace and we talk about the Jebusite wall, that is part of the city that these Jebusites were occupying. Adonai Zedek, probably his fortress was probably up on top of that step stone wall structure with his fortresses up on top of that. And you can see from, again, standing on the Mount of Olives, you can look down over the Kidron Valley at the old city of Jerusalem, the city of David, and you can see the terrace. Sometimes it might be called the Milo. It means the retaining wall. It refers to retaining wall in some of the writings of Samuel and Kings. Anyway, that's where they're at now. Adonai Zedek, king of Jerusalem, heard that Joshua had taken Ai and totally destroyed it, doing to Ai and its king as he had done to Jericho and its king. And the people of Gibeon had made a treaty of peace. Now, where's Gibeon at? Gibeon is within, you can see it. You know, it's 7 miles away, but you can see, well, you can see Gibeon is on the other side of the hill. But, I mean, they're very close, is what I'm saying. And that the Gibeonites had made a treaty of peace. So, I mean, their whole culture, their whole political network is collapsing. Some cities have been burnt and the kings are completely gone. Some kings are buying in or are selling out to the Israelites. And now Adonai Zedek has to say, what am I going to do? Am I going to stand and wait and get burnt? Am I going to sell myself to be a wood carrier? Or am I going to fight? And how am I going to fight alone? So, he and his people, verse 2, were very much alarmed at this because Gibeon was an important city like one of the royal cities. And again, royal cities probably falls under some kind of an umbrella with connections to Egypt. That's where those letters are being sent back and forth at this time. Some kind of a royal city that's in contact with Egypt. Again, they are going to find an excavation. They're going to find Egyptian statues in many of these places, from Hazor and Megiddo. They're going to find the remains of Pharaoh statues that they'd come up and conquered or were ruling at some time during this period. They were very much afraid. It was a large, important city. It was larger than Ai, and all its men were good fighters. The Gibeonites were good fighters. So Adonai Zedek of Jerusalem appealed to Hoham, king of Hebron. Now, Hebron would be down, it's really right about here. I'll put a dot right here, but it's a little bit further down, as if my map was even worthy of saying it's 2 inches off. Piram, king of Jarmuth, Japhia, king of Lachish, and Debir, king of Eglon. Now, these other, like Lachish, was going to be over here. That's going to be close to Azekah. These cities are right, basically, we will call this the southern, some of the southern cities. The entrance and the central cities have been lost. He's going south. We've still got to go north into Hazor, but he's building up his southern campaign here. Let me see where I'm at. Oh, okay, got it. Sorry. Thank you. Wish we'd have a real teacher show up sometime. Okay. Now, verse 3. So Adonai Zedek, king of Jerusalem, appealed to Hoham, king of Hebron, Piram, king of Jarmuth, Japhia, king of Lachish, and Debir, king of Eglon. Come up and help me attack Gibeon, he said, because it has made peace with Joshua and the Israelites. They are now traitors. It'd be like Minnesota joining with Canada in an attack against America. Yeah, good example. Verse 5. Then the five kings of the Amorites, the kings of Jerusalem, Hebron, Jarmuth, Lachish, and Eglon, joined forces. They moved up with all their troops and took up positions against Gibeon and attacked it. So they're getting ready to attack Gibeon. The Gibeonites then sent word to Joshua in the camp at Gilgal. Do not abandon your servants. Come up to us quickly and save us. Help us, because all the Amorite kings from the hill country have joined forces against us. And once again, you get an insight, at least I do, to what a covenant would mean. Because if I'm over here at Gilgal, and these guys that have just tricked me into joining them in a covenant are going to be attacked, it's kind of like, oh, well, let's see how this works out. And just watch him get mowed over and my problem solved. But Joshua doesn't have that option. Why? Because part of a covenant is when they're in trouble, you help them. We are the same. We are partners. We're together. And so Joshua knows good and well, if he watches them burn, there will be judgment for having violated a covenant. And again, the Lord is brought into this covenant because Joshua's in covenant. You see that? I mean, just make a point. The Lord made a covenant with Israel, who made a covenant with the Gibeonites, who are now being attacked by Adonai Zedek and his coalition of kings. So the Gibeonites call to Israel for help, and Israel's got to respond because they're in a contract. And when Israel responds, the Lord has to respond. Now you can see why that, when God is eventually going to have problems, when Israel starts living wickedly, he's going to say, we've got some major covenant violations going on. I can no longer protect you. Well, we saw that a little bit at Ai the first time. And the Lord himself will have to turn and fight against Israel because it becomes so corrupt. But right now, when the Gibeonites need help, they're getting this whole line of covenants brought together, which is interesting. The Lord now is fighting with the Gibeonites. verse 7. I see 6. The Gibeonites then sent word to Joshua camp, "Do not abandon your servants. Come up to us quickly and save us. Help us because of the Amorite kings and the hill country." Oh, there's 7. So Joshua marched up from Gilgal with his entire army, including all the best fighting men. No more AI. We'll just take a few of our good guys. We'll take everybody. The Lord said to Joshua, "Do not be afraid of them. I have given them into your hand." Now, of course, this works in with God's plan. I want to destroy them anyhow, but it is interesting that the Lord is going to cooperate with his covenant with Israel, as Israel cooperates with their covenant with the Gibeonites. He said, "Give them into your hands. Do not be afraid. Not one of them will be able to withstand you." After an all-night march from Gilgal, Joshua took them by surprise. The Lord threw them into confusion. So Joshua is going all night long, is going to march from Gilgal, right down here, which is in the Arba Valley, you know, outside of Jericho. He's going to march, which again is a steep climb. It's like we talked before. It's like a 45-minute drive on a bus from Jericho to Jerusalem, uphill all the way. They're going to march from the Arabah up into this hill country, up into the high ranges here, which is at the top of, when you go much further past Gibeon, you start going down into the coastal plain. Again, there's some mountainous areas there. But that's a tough march. That is a tough march from here all night long. And the Gibeonites are being attacked by this coalition of kings. So he's marching up all night long. So they've marched all night. Verse 9, from Gilgal, the Lord threw them into confusion. The Gibeonites were not expecting, Adonai Zedek and his coalition was not expecting an invasion from the east. The Lord threw them into confusion before Israel, who defeated them in a great victory at Gibeon. Israel pursued them along the road going up to Beth Horon and cut them down all the way to Azekah and Makeda. Now, again, they've climbed up this whole way, and this road, this Beth Horon Ridge Road, you're on the high part of the country here, and there's a main road going here. They pursued them all the way across there, and they're chasing them down into the coastal plain. They're going to head down to the Ajalon Valley right here. So they're chasing them. And these guys are fleeing. Lachish and these cities, these guys are fleeing down and heading back south, trying to find some kind of refuge, heading back to their homelands. They moved all their troops in verse 7. What? 11. Thank you so much for paying attention. Okay. As they fled before Israel on the road down from Beth Horon to Azekah, and again, Azekah, you know, Azekah's down in here. That's down towards the Valley of Elah. In fact, you can see where David killed Goliath in the Valley of Elah from Azekah and Makeda. And they fled before Israel on the road down from Beth Horon to Azekah. The Lord hurled large hailstones down on them from the sky. So he's definitely in on this. And more of them died from the hailstones than were killed by the swords of the Israelites. On the day the Lord gave the Amorites over to Israel, Joshua said to the Lord in the presence of Israel, "O sun, stand still over Gibeon." They'd marched all night. We can't have the sun go down. So I need help. I need divine. He says, "I need divine help. I need a sun in the heavens of your help. I need the sun to stand still so we can finish the battle." So the sun, watch this. "The sun stands still over Gibeon, O moon over the valley of Ajalon." And that valley of Ajalon, again, here's the city of Ajalon. The valley of Ajalon runs right up through here. You can see it when you stand at Gezer. You can look over the city walls or the city gate, and you can see the valley of Ajalon is right there. And that is the valley that they're being chased through. So the sun stood still and the moon stopped till the nation avenged itself on its enemies, as it is written in the book of Jashar. Now, again, the book of Jashar is going to be referred to in the book of Judges and other places. It's a book of poetry. It's an Israel poetry book of their battles. We don't know. We don't have it. We don't know what it is. We may find it sometime, but we do have excerpts that's quoted, taken from Israel's poetic military victory songs brought over into this example here. As it is written in the book of Jashar, "The sun stopped in the middle of the sky and delayed going down about a full day." Now again, this is one of those verses. It's like next to the flood of Noah. That's like, how do you handle this? You just read it and let the Lord defend himself. You know what I mean? It's like I was reading something today, and someone says, instead of trying to, you know, argue about if Jesus is the only way, don't, you know, well, Christianity is so exclusive and it's so narrow-minded. It's like, well, you just stick with the text and let Jesus deal with it. You know, he's the one who says, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. It's like, do you follow Jesus? Yes, I do. Well, then just tell him what he said. It's like, well, that's closed-minded. I don't know. That's what he said. Take it up with Jesus. I'm sorry. You know, and the same thing here. It's like, what about, how'd this happen? I don't know. I mean, the sun stopped. Joshua needed more time. I mean, he marched all night. I mean, he's got a lot of fighting going on here. He's tired. He needs to get this done. Wants to get back home to the family. And we don't want to keep this going for another day. Let's just get this job done. And God, who's in covenant here, he just stops the sun, or something happens that this takes place. There has never been a day like it before or since. So if you'd say, that stuff doesn't happen anymore. Right. It says it right here. It doesn't never happen before, never happened since. A day when the Lord listened to a man and just stopped the universe. The soul just stopped. Surely the Lord was fighting for Israel. And the whole point, why? Because the Lord was fighting for his covenant people, Israel. This is an amazing event. Why would God do something like that? He's serious about Israel. You may want to take Israel serious. They've got a covenant with him. Then Joshua returned with all Israel to the camp at Gilgal. Now the five kings had fled and hidden in the cave at Makeda. When Joshua was told that the five kings had been found hiding in the cave of Makeda, he says, roll large rocks up to the mouth of the cave and post some men there to guard it. But don't stop. Pursue your enemies, attack them from the rear, and don't let them reach their cities, for the Lord your God has given them into your hands. So they're going to keep right on going, keep this battle going. They're going to block one of the caves shut near down here by Ajalon, down in this area. They put the caves in a king. The kings are in a cave. They block it shut, but just keep right on going. Get their people, and don't let those kings escape. Roll large rocks. Okay, but don't stop. So verse 20. So Joshua and the Israelites destroyed them completely, almost to a man, but a few who were left reached the fortified cities. The whole army then returned safely to Joshua at the camp at Makeda, and no one uttered a word against the Israelites. Joshua says, open the mouth of the cave and bring those five kings out to me. So they brought the five kings out of the cave, the kings of Jerusalem. So Adonai Zedek, Hebron, Jarmuth, Lachish, and Eglon. These were the five kings. When they had brought these kings to Joshua, he summoned all the men of Israel and said to the army commanders who had come with them, come here and put your feet on the necks of these kings. So they came forward and placed their feet on their necks. Now do realize, you go back in time and you've got Joshua, a younger man, in the wilderness with 12 other spies coming up to spy out the land. Joshua and Caleb say, we can do this. The other 10 spies went back and says, we can't. These men are too tough. The army, the walls are too big. The men are too tall. We can't do this. And discouraged the people of Israel. They brought a bad report. 40 years in the wilderness. They've now come up. Joshua's 40 years, 45 years older. And now he's finally doing what him and Caleb had a chance to do. And these are the men that kept them in the wilderness for 40 years because everybody else was afraid of them. So now he's got his soldiers, he's got his officers, he's got his administration standing. He says, you put your feet on these men's necks. These are the great kings that you were afraid of. This is what kept us in the wilderness for 40 years. Now they're on their faces, your feet are on them, and who is going to harm you? But notice, it's that covenant. The Lord, Israel, and they're fighting for covenant people, Gibeonites. So he has them put their feet on their necks. Come here and put your feet on the necks of these kings. So they came forward and placed their feet on their necks. Joshua said to them, do not be afraid. Do not be discouraged. Be strong and courageous. This is what the Lord will do to all the enemies you're going to fight. He says, this is just the beginning. And notice the words that he's preaching are the words the Lord is preaching to him. Do not be afraid. Do not be discouraged. Then Joshua struck and killed the kings. You say, well, it wasn't very nice to put their feet on their necks. Well, yeah, read this next one. Then Joshua cut their heads off. Say, okay, that wasn't so bad putting their feet on their necks then. Then Joshua struck and killed the kings and hung them on five trees, and they were left hanging on the trees again until evening. So they're decapitated corpses hanging on trees. And again, the reason I think they're hanging on trees is to display the victory. It's like, we have conquered these kings as a sign to other kings and the people we have taken over. And of course, they do not let them stay overnight. That's either too disgraceful or too much into the witchcraft and spiritual world or something of what goes on at night. In verse 27, at sunset, Joshua gave the order and they took them down from the trees and threw them into the cave where they had been hiding. At the mouth of the cave they placed large rocks, which are there to this day. That day Joshua took Makeda, the city. He put the city and its king to the sword and totally destroyed everyone in it. He left no survivors, and he did to the king of Makeda as he had done to the king of Jericho. And that is now what we've seen, the entrance campaign here into the hill country. We've seen the central campaign right here with the Gibeonites going over to Ajalon and Jerusalem and some of the kings that came up to help. We got the entrance and the central campaign. We're going to next week talk about the southern campaign, and once we got that, we're going to turn and go north up to Hazor, and you'll have the northern campaign. In fact, if you look right there, chapter 10, verses 29 to the end of the chapter, verse 42, that's the southern campaign. And then chapter 11 is the northern campaign. Chapter 11 through 12 will be the northern campaign. And again, that's what we're reading here is about 5 years worth of battle. This is not something that took place this weekend, you know. Then on Monday we defeated this, then we took the southern campaign. No, this is probably from the entrance to the south up to the north is probably, and this is debatable, of course, it's probably a 5-year period of conquering the land. And we'll have to leave that off for right now. It's kind of funny. In chapter 12, you got a list of all the kings that were defeated. And then in verse chapter 13, the land that's still to be taken. And that's when Joshua says, the Lord tells him, you're very old, and Joshua's getting ready to die, and they're going to divide the land up. Okay, I'm going to quit. I appreciate you listening. It's kind of there's a lot of things you could talk about. Each of these battles can be drawn because you can go and draw battle lines. You can find these valleys. You can find these cities. You can see the land that they are fighting. The land hasn't changed. You know what I'm saying? There's not new mountains and new valleys. I mean, some topography has changed to some extent, but you can see a lot of these places. So you can draw up these battlefields, and Joshua is one of the generals that is studied in military history, because again, we can read about the Lord doing this, but Joshua was the one leading all these campaigns and sweeping through this land in apparently a 5-year period. So again, a lot more can be discussed in this, and battle lines can be drawn, and it can become a very involved study. I'm going to pray, and then you are dismissed. Thank you very much for being here. Father, we do thank you again for the chance to look into your word. We thank you for your faithfulness and the example that you set of your faithfulness. We ask that we would expect the same faithfulness from you in our lives, but Father, we would also portray the faithfulness that you've shown to us and the love that you've shown to us to others as we would, again, become Christ-like in our lives. We do thank you so much for the good things you've done for us, and ask that we would continue to grow in our understanding and in our application of these truths. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you very much for your patience.